Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the forum, where science comes to socialize, of course. I'm Cleo, and here with me, I've got Aubrey and Daniela. Today, we're diving into a paper that was debated at the Institute on Science for Global Policies conference, Equitable, Sustainable, and Healthy Food Environments, that took place in Vancouver, Canada, aka my future home.
Wait, you're moving to Canada? When did this happen?
Okay, future home may be strong vocabulary for this situation. I liked it a whole bunch and dream of going to UBC one day.
Ah, Cleo, do you remember that little pier that we went to with the market and all the fresh fruits?
Ugh, the golden raspberries.
Yes, I'm not even a city person, but it was gorgeous there. Wait, weren't you supposed to be working?
Well, yeah, but everyone needs a little vitamin D.
Must have been beautiful through those conference room windows, huh?
Shush, you weren't there. You couldn't possibly understand the magic.
Okay, but speaking of conference windows and a beautiful time of year for British Columbia, this conference took place in May of 2016 and was convened in partnership with Simon Fraser University.
The paper we're focusing on today comes from Dr. Mindy Curser, a professor in the Department of Food Science and Nutrition, as well as the director of the Healthy Foods, Healthy Lives Institute at the University of Minnesota.
And preemptively, if you want to share any comments or questions you have about this paper, catch us at ISGP Forum on Twitter or search for ISGP's The Forum on Facebook. You can also head on over to the Publications tab at scienceforglobalpolicy.org to take a look at the paper for yourself.
So basically, today we're talking about how undernutrition is a major problem in both the developing and developed worlds.
It's not only undernutrition, though, because we're also dealing with serious health issues stemming from obesity. The two challenges are intimately intertwined.
Good thing I just finished off a pint of Ben and Jerry's before recording this sesh. Definitely don't feel awkward or self-conscious about it now or anything like that.
That's all right. We all have those moments, Cleo, except for me because I'm mostly lactose and gluten intolerant, which severely limits the types of food I can binge eat.
And for that, I am so sorry you have to lead such a sad and deprived existence.
You know, it's okay. They're slowly getting better at dairy-free ice cream, and sometimes it almost tastes like more than cold, lightly sweetened air. And on the gluten front, don't you remember we went out for gluten-free pizza in Vancouver after one of the conference nights, you know, like around midnight?
Okay, if you could stop making me hungry for just a hot sec.
Sorry.
Okay, cool. Well, at first, these topics, undernutrition and obesity, may seem extremely contradictory to be talking about in the same conversation, because let's be real, the first thing we think of when imagining undernutrition is certainly not an overweight population.
It turns out, though, that these problems are way more connected once you go just a hair deeper into the issues. To give some context here, the main food-related issue that policymakers have been hyper-focused on for the last 50 some odd years has been a lack of sufficient food.
Which, of course, is pretty justified since almost 800 million people in the world are classified as hungry. In fact, one in every six kids in the United States faces hunger.
Wait, I don't see that in the paper here.
Oh, no, it's not. I learned it watching Food Network.
Classic.
Thanks. But here are some more scary facts that you will find in Dr. Curser's paper. The physical growth of 200 million children under the age of five has been stunted because of undernutrition. And about 2 billion people are experiencing poor physical and cognitive development because they don't have enough of the right kinds of food.
I'm glad you mentioned the words right food, Aubrey, because it's super important for us to distinguish types of food in this conversation. We're not just talking energy or calories consumed here, but the levels of essential micronutrients too. So things like vitamins, iron, iodine, zinc, all of that.
Despite policymakers' efforts to facilitate increases in the consumption of micronutrients, these deficiencies are still rampant and prevalent all over the world. An estimated 250 million children are vitamin A deficient, causing 500,000 of them to go blind every year.
I personally know some chemists who are probably vitamin D deficient from locking themselves in the lab all day.
You know, that's not what we're going for here.
Just trying to add some levity to a really depressing conversation. Jeez.
Okay, fair enough.
But if we're rattling off sad malnutrition facts, did you know that in developing countries, billions of people are affected by iron deficiency, and half of pregnant women and 40% of preschool-aged children are anemic. And having anemia here in the U.S. is totally different than being anemic in a developing country. While here it makes me kind of tired and unable to donate blood, in a developing country it could mean the difference between life and death.
These conditions can lead to poor pregnancy outcomes, maternal death, and impaired physical and cognitive development. But now it's my turn to chime in with an unfortunate statistic. Here it is. Iodine deficiency affects almost 800 million people worldwide.
And you may be thinking, hey, that doesn't sound so terrible, since when is iodine super important? Well, turns out that iodine deficiency is a major cause of cognitive disabilities. On top of all of this, zinc deficiency impairs growth and is responsible for the death of 800,000 children per year. Not 8,000, not 80,000, but 800,000.
Immune deficiencies caused by a lack of zinc, iron, and vitamin A rank among the top 10 leading causes of death through disease in the developing world. Yeah, these are not numbers to scoff at all.
What's super crazy, though, is that at the same time all these deficiencies are occurring, the number of overweight and obese people worldwide has increased significantly, now estimated to be over 2 billion people. This means that for the first time in human history, the number of overweight and obese people globally is roughly equal to the number of undernourished people.
In the U.S., 69% of adults are considered overweight or obese. The percentage of obesity in children is 8% for ages 2 to 5,
18% for ages 6 to 11,
and 21% for ages 12 to 19. It's no wonder, then, that in low to middle income countries, obesity-related chronic diseases like diabetes and cardiovascular disease are becoming the fastest growing causes of death. What's interesting now, though, is that these are the same places that are also struggling with high rates of undernutrition.
And since that sounds very counterintuitive, let's discuss a case study.
Okay, so let's take Mexico, for instance, where undernutrition affects up to 36% of the population in some states. Nationally, 18% of the population experiences moderate food insecurity, and 11% experience severe food insecurity, where the greatest prevalence occurs among rural indigenous communities, as well as those facing poverty.
A total of 18% of pregnant women and 23% of preschool children are anemic, but simultaneously, 33% of Mexico's population is obese. Taking all of these numbers into consideration, and we recognize that there's a lot, Mexico struggles with what experts call the quote-unquote double burden of having a population that's both overweight and undernourished. Sometimes this double burden occurs in the same community, same family, or even in the same person.
Mexico certainly isn't the only country facing these serious issues, though. In India, 48% of children under the age of 5 are anemic, while 20% of adults and 11% of teens are overweight or obese.
And in the U.S., obesity is for sure a serious problem. It's almost become a sad joke incorporated into comedy routines and pop culture.
That is unfortunately really true. For example, in the new Mean Girls musical on Broadway, for instance.
What, seriously? We're quoting Mean Girls now?
I mean, have you seen it?
No, but...
Then you have absolutely no idea where I'm going with this, because I did see it, and we're going to use this for sure. So, in one of the very first scenes when Katie and her family are discussing moving from Africa to America, Katie has this line before she starts singing about trying Starbucks venti chai, where she says, and this is pretty much a quote, "Maybe I'll meet an obese person." And the whole audience laughs because, let's face it, Erica Henningsen times it really well, and Tina Fey is pretty hilarious. But that's the kind of joke that's become synonymous with America. We're numb to this perception that we overeat and have massive portion sizes. But that laughter is masking a pretty grim reality that most people either have no idea about or, I guess, have learned to selectively ignore. It's the reality that many, many Americans are obese and many, many are significantly undernourished. And sorry for the continuing waterfall of downers that seem to have become this episode, but in the U.S. especially, this undernourishment is often associated with poverty.
And since Dr. Kurzer is from Minnesota, let's use that as an example. So Minnesota, which often ranks as one of the top most livable places in the U.S., by the way, has poorer communities that do not experience equal levels of health, access to healthy food, or economic successes that the rest of the state thrives off of. Minnesota has the fifth largest agricultural economy when comparing all U.S. states. Yet in Minnesota, there are 3.5 million visits to food shelves per year, and 20% of families with children face food insecurity.
As we've seen with the other examples, though, this is all happening at the same time that two-thirds of all Minnesotans are overweight or obese. In fact, $2.8 billion are spent each year on obesity-related healthcare. Many of these people live in poverty, and some are both malnourished and overweight.
So now that everyone listening is thoroughly depressed, as well as either fat or malnourished, apparently.
Or both.
True, or both. Let's back this up a little further to see how on earth we got into such a mess in the first place, according to Dr. Kurzer.
That's a good idea. I mean, maybe if we understand the cause, we can propose some realistic solutions. So, the Green Revolution is likely something you've heard about before, at least in a high school U.S. history class or something like that. But we're going to give you a quick recap here. During the 1960s, we had a huge increase in the production of corn, wheat, and rice, which is often credited with reducing the occurrence of famine all over the world. You know, because more food usually means fewer hungry people.
But the Green Revolution is also criticized for having a negative impact on food quality, as the grain monocultures, think huge rolling wheat fields, are often exported or used for animal feed or biofuel.
This trend is in opposition with the use of polycultures for local consumption. The Green Revolution, while producing more food, actually caused agricultural biodiversity to decrease while increasing both pesticide use and soil nutrition depletion. Taken together, this all adds up to lower levels of micronutrients in our food.
So essentially, the increase in production and availability of grains caused hunger and starvation to decrease, but micronutrient deficiencies continue even today, and hunger has yet to be eradicated. It's its own double burden, so to speak.
But a lot of people still maintain that a new green revolution is needed to feed our growing population, and it's definitely something we've talked about a lot here on the forum before. However, plot twist, some calculations of food production suggest that we're actually already producing enough food to feed everyone in the world.
In 2011, almost 2,900 calories were available in the world per person per day. Yay, food production! This was actually an increase from 2,600 calories per person per day in 1990, which is really remarkable considering that the world's population grew by about 2 billion during that time. I don't do math, but that seems like a pretty significant percentage of growth.
These data, of course, suggest that when it comes to dietary energy, there's definitely enough food on the planet to feed everyone.
At this point, you may be asking yourself, so why are there still hungry people, and why does so much undernourishment exist if there's clearly enough food? Well, the primary answer to this question is poverty.
Poverty results in insufficient income to purchase food and a lack of land to grow food. And it's most often caused by a lack of resources, unequal income distribution, and political and social instability. The World Bank estimates that there are more than 1 billion people worldwide who live on less than a US 125 per day, and 2.2 billion people who live on less than a US $2 per day. Poverty is also caused by hunger, since hunger reduces a person's ability to learn, work, and be productive. So you can see how there are some nasty feedback loops contributing to these issues. In addition to poverty, hunger is caused by food and agricultural policies, climate change, and food waste, like the fact that 33% of all food produced is wasted, which is so ridiculous and awful and literally keeps me up at night.
I hear ya. In the developing world, though, the increases in obesity are due to increasing availability of cheap, energy-dense foods, on top of a lack of physical activity that tends to accompany economic growth and affluence.
And back to Mexico for just a moment. In just a 15-year period, having developed and moved away from a traditional diet of corn and beans, the average Mexican has eaten 29% less fruits and vegetables and 6% more carbohydrates, all while consuming 37% more soft drinks. In fact, Mexicans are the world's second largest consumers of soft drinks, stacking up to 150 liters per person per year.
With white bread replacing tortillas and fast food replacing home cooking, Mexico now has the highest rate of diabetes in the world. And while we've featured some facts and figures from a few specific places in this episode, let's be clear that global shift from undernutrition to simultaneous undernutrition and obesity has occurred in virtually every country, you know, as those countries have developed economically.
As far as we can tell, there are no examples where increases in an overweight, obese populace has been avoided. But by all means, do send us a tweet if you know one.
So hopefully at this point, you have a decent understanding of the expanse and gravity of these issues and see why this is something we so desperately need to handle. It's absolutely critical that while combating undernutrition, policymakers consider the potential unintended consequences of overnutrition and set in place policies to avoid its development.
These types of solutions will most likely have to be country dependent, and in some cases will require policy changes at the national, regional, or local level. For the sake of this particular policy position paper, Dr. Kurzer focused mainly on the developed world when it came to her suggestions for policymakers.
She also relied heavily on steps that have already been put into place in Minnesota as a sort of springboard for suggestions moving forward. So, as an example, the Minnesota Department of Health, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, and the University of Minnesota Healthy Food, Healthy Lives Institute led the effort to develop a plan to address its state's nutrition problems.
As a result, the Minnesota Food Charter launched in 2014, and it serves as a roadmap describing 99 actionable policy and systems changes that will create a healthier state. We certainly don't have time to go over all 99 of those with you today, but if you're interested, you should totally go check them out by visiting mnfoodcharter.com. The purpose is to essentially lay a foundation for research and policy that will reduce both undernutrition and overnutrition in the state.
These recommendations are applicable at all levels and consist of five key actionable steps. First, improve food and nutrition knowledge and skills. So this means requiring things like school programming, clear nutrition labels on food, because we all know how confusing and annoying that can be, and required menu labeling. I can tell you firsthand that those menu labels totally mess up your usual routines. Like at Panera, I used to always get the cheesy potato soup in a bread bowl until I found out it had like an entire day's worth of calories and fat in it. Which is fine when you're a high schooler running track and playing soccer, but not quite the same when you're a sedentary graduate student.
I think Daniela and I can relate to that strongly. Next, there's the recommendation to make healthy food more affordable. Yes, I'm looking at you, Whole Foods. Government subsidies can be used to lower the price of healthy foods like fruits and vegetables so that it could be more economically viable to reach for an apple as opposed to Ruffles, even though Ruffles have ridges. So to help with this, governments can also restrict the marketing of and increase prices of high sugar, high fat foods.
You mean so that you can't rattle off food slogans in the middle of an educational podcast episode?
Yep, that's the idea. It'll certainly make my job harder, but I'm willing to take one for the global team.
Actually, guys, Mexico bans TV advertising of high calorie foods and drinks and even imposes taxes.
Good point. And on a related note, reducing poverty through economic development will provide people with the resources they actually need to purchase healthy foods.
We also have to increase food availability and accessibility, though. A lot of people buy much of their food at convenience stores that generally don't have stuff like fresh, nutrient-dense food. Think about your local gas station. Are you more likely to see kale or Cheetos? Policymakers can actually implement city ordinances that require convenience stores to provide these types of food.
Cheetos? Aren't they already doing pretty well with that one?
No, I meant the kale in that example. But of course, things like cultural food requirements and food sovereignty of indigenous peoples would have to be considered in the financing of healthy food initiatives, just like this one.
Dr. Kurzer also recommends that we institute necessary changes in food infrastructure. On a global scale, this can be divided up into five categories, some of which you might not even traditionally think of when you imagine the word infrastructure. These include a need for diversification of crops and agricultural practices that increase the production of nutrient-dense foods. And this could occur through government incentives and subsidies, and also biofortification through private industries. other food infrastructure needs involve improvements in gender equity and the empowerment of women who, by the way, do most of the agricultural work, lead the families, and raise children in much of the world.
The third piece of the puzzle is decreasing food waste at home, throughout the food chain, like in manufacturing, transportation, and storage, as well as in the food service setting.
We need to improve access to markets for small farmers and also incorporate nutrition objectives into agricultural programs and policies.
Finally, Dr. Kurzer's last policy suggestion is that we must support collaborations among nutritional scientists, public health workers, farmers, food manufacturers, economists, sanitation experts, the list is continuing, civil engineers, policymakers, and any other major stakeholder who may want in on this challenge of combating the double burden. A major barrier to effective collaboration is that these disciplines and groups are generally isolated from each other within universities and governments and wherever else they exist.
Exactly. So the agricultural sector, let's say, focuses on production, but not consumption or human health. That job is for the nutrition sector, which focuses on nutrients, but not foods or agriculture. These groups have got to start working together to improve nutrition and health.
And we could begin that process by having the U.S. Dietary Guidelines consider impacts on food production when making consumption recommendations. Of course, we're going to need some rigorous research to determine the impact of agricultural, educational, social, cultural, and economic programs and policies. This could take place in research universities or government-supported research institutes.
So that about wraps it up then, I think. Now, go forth and fix our food system. Just kidding, but you totally can send in any questions or comments you had about today's episode by going to facebook.com/ISGPforum or by tweeting us at ISGPforum. Have any creative solutions to fixing the double burden of obesity and undernutrition? Did you know about this conundrum before today's episode? Let us know.
We look forward to chatting with you all soon. Thanks so much for socializing with science today, everyone, and we will see you next time right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.